From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Relations between Australia and China have plunged even further over the past week, with punitive tariffs imposed on Australian wine and a shouting match over an offensive Chinese tweet about the war crimes allegedly committed by a small number of Australian soldiers in Afghanistan. Today our guest is Bates Gill, who is Professor of Asia-Pacific Security Studies at Macquarie University. Bates Gill is a long-time expert on China, and he has a forthcoming book on goals driving China's foreign policy under Xi Jinping, which will be out with Oxford University Press next year. Bates Gill, can we start with the Chinese government official tweeting an image depicting an Australian soldier holding a knife to the throat of a child? Why do you think the Chinese chose such a provocative action, or is it simply of a piece with everything else they're doing at the moment in relation to Australia?
Well, let's start off by saying that this was offensive even by the standards of this particular individual, Zhao Lijian, who is a well-known so-called wolf warrior diplomat whose first Twitter account opened in 2010 and has become well-known for this sort of controversial tweets. Why now? Well, it's very much in the context of a spiraling deterioration in Australia-China relations, and I think it's an added layer of warning, of unhappiness, underscoring what is already a very, very bad political situation between the two countries. All that said, though, this is qualitatively different and is intended to do exactly what it's done, which is to provoke and send a signal to Australia.
Well, in that context, do you think Scott Morrison was right to push back so hard over the tweet, or would it have been better to just play it more low-key?
Well, this must have been a very hard call for the Prime Minister. On the one hand, Zhao Lijian is a mid-ranking Ministry of Foreign Affairs official, perhaps a first response could have come from a lower ranking individual here in Australia to be followed up then by the Prime Minister. But at the end of the day, this was such a provocative act, hitting such sensitivities in Australia, concerning an issue of high domestic political importance. Whether that's the respect which the society offers to the men and women in uniform here, and even more importantly, the ongoing investigation into possible war crimes. It was of a nature, I think, that the Prime Minister would have had to have stepped forward at some point. So I support the remarks that he made. The timing might have been a little bit different, but I think he's spot on.
More generally, it was only in 2013 that the Gillard government concluded a strategic partnership with China. How has the relationship gone so awry in a relatively few years? How much is this deterioration driven by what's happened within China?
Well, I think both sides have to share some of the blame, I guess, or the responsibility, at least, for the direction that the relationship has taken, and it has taken a very dramatic turn for the worse in just a few short years. But I think it's no coincidence, really, that you could mark that same period since 2013 to today as overlapping almost directly with the leadership of Xi Jinping in China, who took up his current seats of power in late 2012. Xi has taken a very different approach to international affairs and China's role within the international community. A lot of people have pinned different names to it, more assertive, more ambitious, lots of words we could give it. But I think it has certainly been characterized by Xi's intention to make China great again and to push hard back on criticism of others, particularly when it shaves close to issues of high sensitivity to China. So as a result, I think we've seen this deterioration unfold, both because of China's more aggressive and assertive behavior in international affairs, but I think also the reactions in places like Australia, which feel, I think, necessarily the need to push back. And here we are. The problem is that this is not going to go away anytime soon. And I think this is really going to, this is the new normal for relations between Australia and China.
So in terms of the pushback, do you think that a number of Australian policies have been justified or unjustified? For example, obviously the foreign interference legislation under Malcolm Turnbull was quite a thing for the Chinese. More recently, under Scott Morrison, the calling for an inquiry into the origins of COVID and the early handling, were such initiatives desirable by Australia or ill-judged?
I think in both cases, the policies themselves, I don't think are really the problem. In many respects, it was the way it was handled, the way that it, the messaging that surrounded it, that probably created a little bit more angst and unhappiness for Beijing. So I really don't quibble with the need to have smarter and more effective means to push back and protect Australian society from undue and unwelcome interference. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think there's anything wrong with an international investigation into the sources of the COVID-19 pandemic, which, of course, ultimately we do have now under the auspices of the WHO. I think for China, what their real problem is the degree to which those sorts of policies identify and specifically target, and even more sensitively for China at least, call into question the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party as a part of those overall policy means. But quite honestly, this is something that's going to become increasingly difficult for Australia and many other liberal democracies around the world to avoid, because the nature of the Chinese regime is getting more problematic for those of us in open, liberal, democratic societies. So I don't envy the positions of the prime ministers or any leader of a liberal democratic nation. They are staring into a major foreign policy problem, and that is how to deal with the kind of China that we see emerging on the international scene, which is more and more troubling, engaged in more and more unwelcome activity abroad as well as within our own societies. I think we do need to do something about it, and we have to be prepared to pay some price for it.
Legislation is now being considered and will pass to allow the federal government to revoke agreements that have been made by state governments, for example, notably the Victorian government and the Belt and Road Agreement, agreements with China. Do you think that that is a desirable step?
Well, this really gets into the politics of federalism in Australia, and I recognize that that's a controversial issue. But at the end of the day, if either state governments or even corporations not-for-profit institutions, universities and the like are engaged in activities which are deemed to be contrary to the national interest or even not just contrary, but detrimental, then it strikes me that the federal government has a role and a responsibility in trying to protect against that. The devil, of course, is going to be in the details. Who gets to define what's contrary to the national interest or who gets to define what is or isn't a national security risk? That's a real problem and a difficult one to work through. But I don't think in principle there's anything wrong with a federal government wanting to make sure that the entire country is properly protected from potential external threats.
This proposal covers universities too. Is that going too far?
again, it really boils down to how well this is implemented and vetted and assessed. I don't think there's anything wrong with universities being asked to avoid activity that's going to undermine the national security of the country. And I don't think any university wants to do that either. The problem is defining where precisely you draw that line. To what degree does it begin to impede upon the kind of welcome and natural academic activity that one would want to see flourish? Unfortunately, I think these types of laws can overreach. I think we've seen some examples of that in other countries around the world, notably the United States. So I think this is an issue that deserves very, very robust and healthy debate and deep consultation and coordination between the federal government and the parties that are going to be affected, whether that's a university or state government or even individuals who are engaged in different types of interactions with a country like China. So, I mean, Australia lives, breathes, thrives, can be the nation that it is, economically successful, internationally engaged, because it does have deep and important relationships with countries abroad. So we can't let that internationalist success story of Australia be harmed by this legislation. So overreach is something we should all be looking at very carefully and trying to avoid.
We're hearing a lot at the moment about China's wolf warrior diplomacy, and indeed the deviser of the offensive cartoon depiction of the Australian soldier is a wolf warrior. How does this diplomacy operate?
Well, the term wolf warrior diplomacy was actually coined by a Chinese newspaper, the Global Times. It gets its name from a couple of blockbuster nationalist, chest-thumping, international intrigue films of the same name, in which Chinese special forces, you know, operate abroad and save Chinese. And it's a bit like Rambo-type films. We've really seen this come to the fore over the past year or two. I've done a bit of research and worked with some others on the rapid growth, for example, in the usage of Twitter, the number of accounts that have come online, official accounts from Australia, whether used by diplomats or by government agencies or state-owned media, has just skyrocketed. So this is a relatively new phenomenon, the use of Twitter by these official accounts coming out of China. And of course, the irony there is that Twitter is banned from use inside China, but it's becoming increasingly and more sort of pugnaciously used by Chinese officialdom aimed at external audiences. And, you know, just to boil it down, you know, why this more aggressive posture? In my view, it's trying very much to try and play to the more aggressive and more ambitious atmosphere which Xi Jinping is trying to pursue in terms of Chinese foreign policy, to push back against perceived affronts to Chinese sensitivities, to position China more forcefully in the international community, stake out its interests and desired outcomes in a more effective way, as they see it. It's not to win hearts and minds, certainly. It is primarily, I think, to impress domestic audiences, whether that's one's immediate superiors or Xi Jinping himself. I think there's a bit of personal and professional aggrandizement going on here. By some of these diplomats, seeing if they can out-tweet the other in terms of provoking foreigners and asserting Chinese interests. So this is a phenomenon that we're going to see increase, not decrease. And I think for those of us on the receiving end, I think we have to understand that this is as much about playing to their own hometown crowd and thumping their own nationalist chest in this more assertive and ambitious atmosphere that we see under Xi Jinping, rather than really an effort to try and achieve any particular foreign policy outcome for China.
Do you think that China's increasing assertiveness could translate into military action and a military threat anytime soon?
Well, I think yes, and it already has. I mean, we've seen the border clash with the loss of life along the China-India border a month or two ago. There hasn't been any overt military action against Taiwan, but there's certainly been an increase in just the past year or so of, you know, more aggressive probes by Chinese aircraft and naval vessels, so too around disputed territories in the East China Sea between China and Japan. And of course, we've seen a great deal of military assertiveness in the South China Sea, trying to cow the other claimants and even seeking to, you know, diminish the presence of other naval forces like those of the United States or Australia or others. So, yes, this more assertive behavior certainly translates into a more assertive military agenda on China's part. And I think we do need to be concerned in the next couple of years whether or not Xi believes it is necessary to take even more forceful action against Taiwan. I think that's really the next most likely area where we might see even more assertive military action. For example, perhaps seeking to retake some of the outlying islands of Taiwan, which are in very close proximity to the Chinese mainland. That's, I think, an area that across the Taiwan Strait where a likelihood of a real serious military incident is increasing with each passing day.
And what about more widely in the region?
Well, for the foreseeable future, and by that I guess I might say the next 5 or 10 years, the Chinese military simply is not able to prosecute, you know, the kind of power projection beyond, let's say, the first 100 to 200 kilometers past its shores. So, you know, looking out into the Indian Ocean or into the Western Pacific, you know, the Chinese are not yet at a place where they could really expect to compete effectively, especially in an all-out military conflict with others in the region, whether that's Japan and certainly not the United States. But within that first 100 kilometers or so, just offshore, China has enormous advantages militarily. Most of all, that it can operate land-based aircraft, land-based missiles, and saturate areas that they might want to, and make it a very dangerous and hostile environment for other forces. So that first 100 kilometers encompasses some pretty important areas. That includes the disputed islands with Japan. That includes Taiwan. And, of course, it includes the South China Sea. So in that time frame, I would expect to see a great deal more assertiveness and military threats emanating from China in the next 5 to 10 years within that band offshore from China rather than something further afield.
And how do you think the Biden presidency will affect the dynamics with China?
It's a little hard to predict at this point, but I think a lot of the overall political atmosphere, which has come to settle on the U.S.-China relationship, especially under the Trump administration, is unlikely to change. The overall political mood toward China in Washington, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat overall, is not positive. And I don't expect that the Biden administration is going to, you know, seek some kind of accommodation or reset with China, certainly not on the more sensitive political and military issues. It's possible that on some areas, the Biden administration will look to find some common ground. Climate change comes to mind, obviously. You know, maybe trying to reform the international trading regime, maybe trying to come to some more equitable terms on trade and investment, intellectual property rights, those sorts of less sensitive economic and global climate issues, maybe some cooperation. But the security relationship won't improve, nor will the position on human rights vis-a-vis China. And I think the big change that we will see under Biden is an effort to try and re-enlist American allies in a more concerted counterbalance of China's assertiveness in the region. I don't think the Trump administration was particularly good at strategizing on how to enlist our allies in this effort. And my sense is that there will be some welcoming of that in capitals like Tokyo, in Canberra, and of course in places like Taiwan and even in South Korea. So those are some of the changes I would expect.
Just coming back to the bilateral relationship, do you think it's necessary for Australia to try and diversify its market so it's less dependent as an exporter on China? And is that possible to any extent anyway?
Yes, it's certainly something that should be done, but obviously easier said than done. And of course, it's not something that can be simply done with the flip of a switch. It takes years and years, if not longer, you know, to develop those sorts of markets, get the contracts in place, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, I think as a long-term prospect, it would be wise. One of the problems, of course, is that there simply is not a market like China out there in terms of economic growth. You know, the Chinese domestic market, its economic heft simply is not matched anywhere by any other major market to which Australia would have a natural sort of complementarity in terms of what we export and what they would need. So I think as a long-term prospect, yes, that obviously is already on the minds of the leaders of universities, of iron ore exporters, of winemakers and the like, and good that it is. But it's not going to be easy.
On the key area of iron ore, though, at least China is very dependent on Australia. It doesn't have a ready alternative source, does it? So there's a bit of protection there?
Well, I'm not sure that's quite right. You know, just as Australia is looking to diversify, so too China is looking to diversify in many, many respects. Become less dependent on international supply chains, become less dependent on foreign access to technology, become more dependent on its own domestic market as a driver for its innovation and its technological advancement. And on the question of iron ore and other natural resources, it's true that Australia is China's largest supplier, and you know, something in the range of 60 or 70%, I believe, of Chinese iron ore imports come from our shores. But they are looking, and there are other sources out there. They might not be as good quality, they might not be as reliable, but we would be naive to think that Beijing and its iron ore importers are not looking and are trying to figure out ways to become less dependent on what they see and understand to be a relationship which is not going in a positive direction.
And just finally, what do you think China's end game is in relation to Australia? And how do you see the bilateral relationship evolving over, say, the next 5 years?
Well, in terms of the end game, I think, maybe those 14 grievances, which were deliberately leaked a week or two ago, give us some idea of what China thinks is an ideal state for the relationship with Australia. I think just to sum it up, it would mean keeping our heads down, not criticizing the nature and actions of the regime in Beijing, and just generally being more accommodating and friendly towards China's steady rise and ambitions. That's what they want out of Australia. We can be specific about what that might mean in real policy terms for Australia, but that's what they want. They want respect, and they want Australia to get out of the way. That's not going to happen. And, you know, that's just not the way I would read the nature of the Australian political system or our society in being accommodating to that end state, which Beijing apparently seeks. And so I think we're into a new normal in the relationship, which is one of tension, constant threats and counter threats, and a sort of deterioration in the political relationship, at least, which will make it a kind of constant state of uncertainty and tension between the two capitals.
We end on a rather pessimistic note. Bateskill, thank you very much for talking with us today and sharing your insights. That's all for this podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.